My guest in the studio tonight worked in the UK for 18 years, playing the saxophone in both jazz, funk, and popular settings with artists such as Eric Clapton, Sting, B.B. King, Van Morrison, and Jim Mullen, just to name a few. He's a teacher at the Australian Institute of Music here in Sydney these days, and it's about to release a new album by his band, one of his bands, Hammerhead. It's been 5 years since we last spoke on this program, Jason. Jason Brewer, welcome back to Now's the Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Given it's been 5 years, Jason, we might remind our listener about how you came to play the saxophone. You were a late bloomer to the saxophone, weren't you?
Correct, yes.
So how did that come about, and I guess what inspired you to play?
I went to the UK in 1976 with my family. My father was studying over there, doing his master's, and I sort of reluctantly went along as a 16-year-old and just sort of worked full-time, basically, and made a friend who was a few years older than me who turned me on to John Coltrane and Weather Report, among other sort of more jazz-tinged music. At that stage, I was very passionate about music, but I hadn't really listened to any jazz. And I guess that kind of sowed the seed. I mean, I didn't harbour any sort of feelings of becoming a professional musician or even picking up an instrument, you know. So I'll spend a year in London, sort of working mundane full-time jobs, came back to Australia. A lot of my mates had started playing in bands, some of whom had already been sort of playing through their teens. And I used to sort of go along and listen to them play and used to think, wow, this is pretty cool. And, you know, over the sort of the ensuing couple of years, I just, you know, started listening to a lot more Weather Report, especially Wayne Shorter and John Coltrane. And I sort of, it was almost an epiphany, a kind of light went off and it was like, right, this is what I've got to do. I felt actually quite lost at that point. I didn't have any real direction. I went back to school to do sort of an adult, you know, in a sort of college to do the equivalent of HSC, lasted a term, hated that, had a few mindless jobs, went and lived in Byron Bay and sort of living the life of a hippie for a few months. You know, it was like a kind of bolt of lightning almost, right, this is what you've got to do. And
it's interesting, you know, isn't it? You know, listening to John Coltrane, some saxophonists might have just sort of said, well, hey, you know, I'm never going to be that good and throw your horn away.
Yes.
But you've taken the task on, you've taken on the challenge.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I suppose I was a bit naive. I just thought, look, I got into it, and at the same time my brother had sort of decided, having been a motor mechanic, believe it or not, that he wanted to be a jazz pianist. So he was downstairs in one room practicing 8 hours a day, and I was upstairs practicing. And then I moved out of home soon after that, and basically practiced, you know, between 7 and 9 hours every day for about 3 years, so I could audition at the Adelaide Con and get in as a mature age student because I hadn't finished school. And, you know, basically that's what I did. And that also coincided with my brother doing exactly the same thing, even though he was 2 years older than me. Bizarrely, my sister, who had already had started playing violin at age 7, and she'd gone through school, you know, doing all of the kind of standard music stuff, played with the Australian Youth Orchestra and South Australian Youth Orchestra, et cetera, et cetera. The sort of most natural progression for her to go to was a Bachelor of Music, which just happened to be the same year that Tim and I both auditioned as mature age students. So we all ended up, the three of us, at Adelaide, what was called Adelaide College then. It's now called the Conservatory of Music. So yeah, that was pretty bizarre. So the three of us, I think we're in like at least two or three, if not four classes together.
Wow.
Yeah. And then it just sort of grew from there, you know. And
and I guess that collegial family situation would have been enough to sort of spur each of you on.
Yeah, well, Tim and I certainly, there was certainly a bit of healthy competition there, you know. I mean, Tim basically wore out our Steinway piano. We had an old upright, which was a beautiful instrument, which Tim basically destroyed. if you're listening, bro, I'm sorry, but and he was ferocious. He still is. I mean, Tim's incredibly, you know, motivated to play. So am I. But yeah, so we sort of spurred each other along. Obviously, my sister, coming from a classical background, you know, was going down a different path, but she was incredibly inspiring, as she's a, you know, a kind of, incredibly disciplined, classical musician that I, have incredible amount of respect for. I remember we were all in the same oral class, and my sister would get 99.9%. I think Tim would get sort of mid-60s, and I'd be hovering around 52 or something. So it was a bit embarrassing, but it was good. It was good to go back and think of those times. Tim and I played it, did a lot of playing together in those, early formative years in various kind of lineups. And then I sort of got into a professional outfit that sort of outgrew Adelaide pretty quickly and ended up sort of dragging the band myself pretty much up to Sydney.
Was that Fat Time?
Fat Time, yeah.
Fat Time, yeah. Yeah.
And then we had a lot of success, actually. We became quite well known on the live circuit, and then we won that Star Search show that I think was 85, 86. We were the finalists and won that, and then that sort of, just raised our profile quite considerably, so we were quite in demand on the live circuit. So, some people ask, why did you then sort of abandon, a very successful career in Sydney, sort of in my late 20s, and move to London? And I don't know. I don't know why.
I suppose the world was your oyster at that point in time, and you wanted to go on to bigger and even better things.
Yeah. I was pretty confident. I was probably a bit cocky as well in those days, and the band sort of split up, and I think I had such a good time as a 16-year-old turning 17 in London. Even though I was living with my family, I felt incredibly independent because I was working full time. I was going out, all the time, seeing all my favourite bands that never came to Australia. I've still got a photo album with all the ticket stubs, such seminal bands and gigs like Little Feat Live at the Rainbow, which they went on to make Waiting for Columbus, which is a famous double live album with the Tower of Power horns. Saw some amazing concerts, and I'm sure that sowed the seed of me, then deciding to become a musician. Yeah. So I guess there was no surprise that 10 years later I kind of thought, all right, well, I'll go to London, which was, in actual fact, at the time I was en route to LA. My ticket, I actually had a LA return ticket with a stopover in London. And I just thought, well, I lived in London for a year. It'd be nice to kind of go there and just have a look, and got there and thought, wow, this is great. And
that's where you stayed.
And that's where I stayed, and backpack and a saxophone. Yeah. And came home 8 years ago with a family an incredible journey and set of memories, stuff that I still to this day kind of have to pinch myself to kind of to really understand how a lot of that stuff happened.
How it all happened.
Because you just go, well, music's an amazing thing, you just don't know what's going to happen.
Just being in the right place at the right time, but of course you've got to be ready as well.
Yeah, look, you do have to be ready. You have to be, I got a lot of opportunities, and I guess that if I hadn't played at a reasonable level, then the other opportunities that came from them wouldn't have happened. And whatever that level is, a good professional standard, whatever, I think playing music goes way beyond just being a good musician. A lot of it's hanging around. You got to sort of hang out with people and, you got to be a bit of a chameleon. Mm. I think there's a lot of great players that I know that find that harder to manage, that side of it, and often don't do as well, even though they're wonderful musicians, a lot better than me, but they just can't sort of get to that next level because it's all about the sort of, it's the downtime, a lot of it is, and to a certain extent sort of taking challenges, taking a few risks, and I certainly took a lot of risks. Now, I was young enough to take them without sort of being too worried. Like now, there's no way I would take those risks now,
The group Hammerhead, I mentioned at the top of the show that this group's been around for a few years now, 3 or 4 years?
Three and a half years.
Yeah. Mm. And I mentioned that my understanding was inspired by that hard bop sound, that Art Blakey jazz messengers sound. How accurate is that?
Look, that was the idea. The sort of co-band leader in Hammerhead is a wonderful drummer from Adelaide and an old friend of mine called Duncan Archibald. who, you know, has played with a lot of very big named artists, you know, in Australian jazz, people like Roger Frampton and Mark Simmons in the early 90s, and he played with the Dynamic Hypnotics and did a lot of work with Robbie Soos. And he had a whole pad of basically Art Blakey material that he used to play in a band in the 80s called Big Fun. And I sort of remember that. I mean, I'd sort of basically left. And we got talking one day and I said, man, do you want to, you know, I went through a period a few years ago where I wasn't doing much. I wasn't getting a lot of work. And I thought, look, I've just got to put a few projects together. So I rang up Duncan and he said, yeah, that'd be great. And I think he was quite glad that I'd sort of hit him up to do it, because, you know, when I get motivated and get the bit between my teeth to do something, I, you know, put a lot of energy into it. So we put the band back together and it was really just playing those Blakey charts, which had already been sort of transcribed and arranged like 25 years ago. And we just sort of, it's funny, it immediately gave us a bit of notoriety. And we, you know, I remember, you know, actually the SEMA ringing me. I mean, you know, this just doesn't happen, you know. And I mean, I just couldn't believe it, getting a call from Gordana saying, oh, we heard about Hammerhead, you know, somebody was at the 505 gig, can you play at the Sound Lounge to be part of the international SEMA event or whatever it was. And I thought, wow, this is cool. But then actually, as it turned out, it being a sort of Art Blakey, you know, sound-alike tribute band was sort of actually, it was closing more doors than opening. I found the vehicle very inspiring to write for and to arrange for. So I just sort of, over a couple of years, started throwing in my own arrangements, my own material, and it's sort of now...
It's grown out of that.
Totally grown out of that, but very much inspired.
That's right. The essence is still there.
Because I just love, I just love that music, but, you know, I want to do a slightly more contemporary kind of retelling of it. And I think whilst there are a lot of elements of that music still on a lot of the tunes on this CD, you know, we sort of branch out a little bit as well. You know, there's two tunes that I've written on this one, Wayne's World, which I've sort of written with, you know, paying homage to Wayne Shorter, and For Art's Sake was paying homage to Art Blakey, sort of. So they were two vehicles that I was sort of thinking of those guys when I wrote the tunes.
And this music as well, the standards that are on here, and there are a number of them, it's very close to your heart, isn't it? Because Speak No Evil, Wayne Shorter, one of your great inspirations.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny, the tune, there's a great track that he wrote that he did with Art Blakey called Hammerhead, which is where we got the name of the band, which we used to play and then we sort of stopped playing it. And, you know, in hindsight, it might have been better to put that on the record instead of Speak No Evil. I mean, I love Speak No Evil, and that's actually from a Wayne Shorter album, not when he was with Art Blakey. I think as a composer, Wayne Shorter's right up there as one of my favourites. So, you know, it was appropriate to do not only a tune of his, but also write a tune sort of paying homage to him. You know, Art Blakey, you know, such an influential pioneer in bridging that kind of cooler style of drumming to sort of ferociously in your face, you know, bop, you know, that inspired the likes of, you know, Elvin Jones and Tony Williams.
Yes.
And there's the lineage, you know, that I think he was there, you know, he created that. He was in that sort of pivotal point, you know, after people like Philly Joe and slightly cooler, you know, not quite as heavy hitters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's party jazz.
Yes.
You know? It's uplifting because it's kind of, I don't know, it's in your face and it's great. And, you know, obviously Art wasn't a composer per se, but, you know, he was a great band leader and a great inspiration to a lot of those young musicians.
Your last album, As Above, So Below, which we discussed about 5 years ago, you took a number of years to complete that from start to finish. I think you recorded some parts in London, some parts back here in Australia. In comparing the two albums, I mean, for our listeners' sake, who may haven't heard that album, although, if they've been listening to this program, they would have. But I'd say that album was very much more produced than this one. This one has the elements of being very much in the moment. And of course, that acoustic flavour that comes with that hard bop sound.
Definitely. Yeah, you've totally nailed it. It was interesting. I was doing a couple of seminars at the Australian Institute of Music, where I teach, the other day for the composition department, and I talked at length at the process I went through on As Above, So Below, which was like a 5-year project, in numerous studios, numerous overdubs. As much as I'm happy with the final product, it was sort of huge. For this music, this is the only way to record. We did this in 2 days, basically. A couple of takes of each thing, no click track, a couple of overdubs here and there, and that's it. And as I say in the album, there's no guarantee you're going to get the right inspiration or the right sound, or you're going to gel in that moment. So hard to get everybody together, to record, that you're just sort of hoping that the stars align and everybody's vibed up and you get a good sound. And the engineer that took care of the session, Scotty Henderson, did an amazing job. I mean, half of it is hearing well. We're in three, four different rooms, so it wasn't like we're in a kind of amazing live studio. It's a great studio. The studios we have at AIM are the old Rhinoceros Studios, which INXS owned, which then became Q Studios. The old SSL desk, which I think was purchased in about 1985. So the quality of the gear in the studio there is state of the art, but it's sort of, we had to separate over three rooms, four, sorry, four rooms, and the horns were down the corridor. We were sort of way down the other side of the building, pretty much, in a back room with a big TV monitor where we could see the drummer. Whilst we didn't really have any sight of the rhythm section, we just relied totally on the monitoring, which was really, really good. So it could have been disastrous. I've done sessions like that where you really don't end up with anything that's worth keeping. So fortunately, we did that. In our first session was on in March, and then we did it again another day in May. I mean, it took me that long to find another day that everyone was free,
Well, I guess, and this has been very much a working band, and taking you off a single bandstand and putting you in that situation mustn't have been easy to adapt to.
No, I mean, we did a demo back in the very, beginning, like within the first few months that we put the band together. We did a demo just doing some of the sort of more Art Blakey tunes. So we had a bit of a, and we pretty much used the same format with a couple of changes, but I felt comfortable that we would actually get a really good sound. We mixed somewhere else. We mixed at Richie B's studio. He mixed my last album, did a fabulous job, and he's really the go-to guy in town for jazz. Every album that I've had anything to do with, and this is my fourth one as a sort of band leader or a co-writer or whatever, I always make a point of mixing separately to where I've recorded and then mastering separately from where I've mixed. So you get three sets of fresh ears, three spaces, three different sets of monitoring. I mean, it's not unusual. A lot of artists do that, but it does really work, and at some point you have to hand it over, and that's a great, it's quite sort of liberating to just say, okay, I'm going to sit and listen, but
I
I'm
want your
paying,
feedback.
that's it. Well, I'm paying you, man. Now you're the expert here. I've done my bit,
That's right. The other comment I wanted to make is there's 10 tracks on the album. The album is called Mosaic, and that comes, I guess, from the Art Blakey's and Jazz Messengers album of that name, written by Cedar Walton, and obviously that appears on the album. There's about five jazz standards, really, from the 1960s on the album, and the one that contrasts out of all those, or against that, is the 1996 Pat Metheny piece from his album Quartet, called Sometimes I See. And Jason, I wanted to just get some brief comment from you about this, because this is a ballad that really gives you the opportunity to really blossom here. And obviously, it was a great choice.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I as I said to you before, while we're off air, I sort of thought long and hard about a ballad, and I think it's important to do something that's sort of more reflective. And so many great tunes to choose from. I remember doing a gig with Matt McMahon a couple of months before we recorded, sort of picking his brain about great ballads, and we sort of went, oh yeah, that'd be great, that'd be great. You know, he mentioned a few things that I hadn't thought of, and I've always loved that song, and Michael Brecker recorded it as well on The Nearness of You, which was his ballads album. So, you know, that had the saxophone lead, and I guess not only is Pat Metheny one of my all-time great favourite composers and, you know, just one of the greatest artists that I've seen and heard, love his music, and also, you know, the late, great Michael Brecker. So I guess there was a bit of a sentimental attachment to that tune and Brecker's version of it. And then I thought, well, I was listening to it one day and I was just starting to hear the whole horn thing, and I like the idea of arranging the whole introduction without any accompaniment. Mm-hmm. It ended up being double bass on there as well, which I think kind of underpins all the horns. You know, once I started writing, like, it was I did tweak the arrangement over a period of a couple of weeks, but I pretty much got most of it down in a couple of sessions, because I was so inspired once I started sort of piecing it together. You know, that sort of three horn sort of, you know, I don't know what you call it, sort of, it's like a choral kind of sound, almost like a vocal arrangement, how you might, you know, arrange vocals to do that. And then, you know, and it gave me an opportunity to play a sort of melody that is beautiful, strong melody to play. I like, you know, a 3-4 ballad is also something that's quite nice to play on, you know. So I was, you know, it's one of my favorites on the record, really.
Last time we spoke, Jason, on the program, as I mentioned, was about 5 years ago, and at that point in time we were discussing the jazz scene here in Sydney, and you were expressing some concern, some cause for concern, for the lack of opportunities for emerging musicians. And of course, you're an established educator here in Sydney now, and no doubt bringing a number of saxophonists through, taking up some gigs, I suppose. 5 years on, how do you see the scene now, and how has it changed?
I think it's harder in some respects, because there's always, 5 years will bring about another, I don't know how many, but a number of good players, you know, especially from the con in the jazz world. AIM are producing some really, really good young players as well, not necessarily jazz, but those of us that are still around are still around, and it's really, really difficult. I mean, we were doing 3, possibly 4 gigs a year at 505 and getting healthy crowds, and this will be our first gig there for over a year, because people just stopped coming. You know, the thing is, unless you can spread your wings and get gigs out of town, there's only a few venues that play. Now, in the last year, a great venue called Lazy Bones has shot up in Marrickville, my local area, and it's a fabulous club. It's probably, you know, it's different to 505, but it's as good for different reasons. It's a fabulous venue. So that's been a very, very good addition. But, you know, a lot of other venues have sort of fallen by the wayside. Like, I used to do a lot of, you know, small kind of jazz duo trio gigs, you know, midweek gigs, cafe type gigs.
Yes.
They've all gone. They've all dried up. Basements, very different. Blue Beat. Chris
gone.
Richards gave it a good crack for 2 years, and just nobody went there. Mm. I mean, the only night I ever went there when there was a substantial crowd was Chris Potter.
Yes.
And you couldn't move. And you know, for good reason. I don't know whether I've kind of answered your question. It just changes. In the last few years, I play a lot of weddings and corporate gigs. I mean, that's probably 65% of my work is playing weddings.
Wow.
And corporate. And look, I'm very grateful for that work, and I'm extremely happy to do it. You know, as long as the musicians are good, I'm happy.
Yes.
Because I'm out playing my saxophone, which is what I want to do. I'd much rather be doing that than sitting at home bemoaning the fact that there's, you know, not enough venues putting on jazz, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, in an ideal world, I'd be playing 3 nights a week with Hammerhead, but that's not going to happen. You know, we're going to try and put a bit of a tour together early in the year, with any luck, down to Melbourne, and tie in some workshops, and, you know, but again, I will have to apply for a touring grant to do that, because it's, you know, it's a 6-piece band, and we're all of that sort of age where we just can't go away for peanuts, you know.
Yeah,
we just can't do it. There's a lot to do to put together just, you know, maybe 3 or 4 gigs out of town is, you know, I'm going over to London
in about 10 days for a bit of a holiday. I'm doing a couple of gigs over there, which would be nice because I haven't played over there since, when I lived there, so 8.5 years. So that's going to be great. But when I get back from that, I'll be starting to put together a sort of 4-5 gig tour in March, and it's going to take me that long
to piece it all together.
To piece it together and try and hopefully get some kind of touring grant, if possible. So
it's not easy.
It isn't easy, but you just have to be positive. I think, look, if everybody, I get a bit tired of people just moaning all the time. You know, we're very much a supply and demand industry, and there's a lot of musicians that sort of go, you know, we used to get paid this much, but now we get paid this much. And that's true. You know, I used to make more in a band in 1983 as a band fee than you do now, or certainly the same, if not more. So you could be very negative and very depressed, and a lot of people get very disenchanted. But, you know, I try my best to keep positive because, you know, like, it's still the best job in the world for me.
And this is a piece written by Eddie Harris, Sham Time. What can you tell us about this, Jason?
I mean, Eddie's another sort of, you know, favourite of mine. I mean, he's not kind of rated in the same regard as sort of, Joe Henderson, Wayne Shorter and Sonny Rollins and Dexter Gordon and Joel Coltrane. You know, he's not one of the big five or the big four, but he's just got so much soul.
He was underrated, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was underrated. And he's actually technically got a lot of stuff going on, but what he just has soul, and it's just it's uplifting music. And I just wanted to do something along those lines. So I sort of played around with it a bit, but you know, any of those sort of albums of him with Les McCann and, you know, compared to Watt and all of those kind of, it's just infectious, great music.
1960s was great for this hard bop style.
Mm. Not that this is really hard bop. No. It's kind of more sort of funky.
That's right.
Yeah.
It originally came out in the electrifying Eddie Harris.
Right, so what year was that?
That was the year of my birth, 1967.
Oh, okay. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Mm. So, look, Jason, thanks very much for coming in tonight. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.